Hello. As I've mentioned on this show before, I discovered Doctor Who in the autumn of 1984 on my local PBS station covering Long Island, New York. The very first story that I would have seen any piece of was Time Flight Part 1. The first story where I would have seen the cliffhanger was Arc of Infinity Part 2. I saw most of Arc of Infinity Part 4, and then didn't watch for a few days and missed all of Snake Dance. I then started watching somewhere in the middle of Maudrin Undead again. A cliffhanger that had a tremendous impact on me was the Part 3 cliffhanger to Maudrin Undead.
Look out! Who are they?
Fools. We tried to turn themselves into Time Lords. It all went disastrously wrong.
It is eternal agony. That is why we long for death.
They're immortal?
For what it's worth.
Help us.
No!
Give us the energy of a Time Lord. Help us to die!
I can't!
For pity's sake.
Doctor, why can't you help them?
Don't you understand? If I did, it would be the end of me as a Time Lord.
I was only 11 years old. I'd only been watching this show for a few days. I didn't know anything about Time Lords or regenerations. But that cliffhanger made me sit up and take notice, and it made me interested in this show. What is a Time Lord? What is regeneration? What does all this mean? Although I did mishear Time Lord and thought the Doctor was saying Time Ward, it was a few more days before I was disabused of that notion. I have heard criticisms in the past of season 20 as being too continuity driven. Quite the opposite for me, though. All those references back to the past made me more interested in the show. And the following episodes would only whet my appetite more. The Five Doctors, Resurrection of the Daleks, where the Doctor references having had a chance to destroy the Daleks before at the moment of their birth. I was fascinated by that reference, and of course, a few weeks later, my PBS station would cycle around to Genesis of the Daleks, and at that point, I was immutably a fan, and nothing would ever change that. And one small but important step on my journey into fandom is this week's episode, Maudrin Undead.
Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.
Well, hi, everybody. Welcome back to Doctor Who Literature, the podcast taking you through the world of the Doctor Who novelizations put out by Target Books, from 1973 onward, in publication order. We're a member of the Direction Point Doctor Who Podcast Network. My name is Jason, and I'm your host on this journey, this very long journey. Last week, at the end of episode 81B, our look at the Five Doctors novelization, I promised you a bonus episode with Adam Christopher. Unfortunately, we were not able to make the recording date work for this week. Remember, this is a weekly show. So Adam is on the clock. We will bring him back as quickly as possible. I am moving up the first episode of season 6 of this podcast, with a season defined as every 2 years' worth of Target Books. We're looking at the January 1984 release of Maudrin Undead. This is a novelization by Peter Grimwade, who previously novelized Time Flight, and has one more novelization to go after this one. Peter was able to novelize all three of his Doctor Who TV scripts. In terms of what's going on in the world of Doctor Who, as I always do, I turn on Pluto TV when I'm recording my intro for Doctor Who Literature. The episode on tonight was part 4 of Planet of the Daleks. I am a big John Pertwee-era fan. Planet of the Daleks may not be the best script of the John Pertwee era. It's probably a fair to middling story. There's really a lot to love about Part 4 in isolation, though. John Pertwee's purple velvet suit is certainly doing a lot of heavy lifting. The chemistry between him and Katie Manning, when Joe returns to his side and talks about being rescued by this bull, that's hilarious. It's a story with a lot of romance, which you don't see in Doctor Who. You have the relationship between Joe and Latep, and you have the relationship between Taran and Rebek, the leaders of the Thal expedition. Now, these are, of course, not torrid, graphic soap opera level romances, but two sets of potential love interests in a single Doctor Who story is pretty rare. That is Terry Nation flexing his storytelling muscles. The color scheme in the story, not just John Pertwee's purple velvet outfit, but the spray paint Daleks graffitied up for the reveal at the episode 1 cliffhanger, and of course the design of the jungle, all reds and purples and dark greens, then the interior design of the Dalek City, makes the story a visual feast. 1973 is the heart of the 1970s, which were defined by their color schemes, and Planet of the Daleks is one of those stories that I enjoy more and more every time I see it. Modern Undead is dedicated to Keith Shand. Modern Undead also has an epigraph, an English translation, from Richard Wagner's The Flying Dutchman. My guest this week, Stephen B., from the New to Who podcast, and I will certainly do some talking about Wagner and his influence on this story over the coming guest interview. But we're reaching the era where a lot more Target books have dedications and epigraphs. We certainly did not see that for much of the 1970s run of the line. We are fortunate here at Doctor Who Literature because we have a terrific resource, Jim Sangster, frequent guest, a producer on the show, good friend. Jim has submitted to me notes on Modern Undead, and he'll talk about the epigraph and the dedication to this book. The book's acknowledgments, Jim writes, credit the translation of The Flying Dutchman to David Putney, which Jim thinks is a typo, and it should be David Putney, P-O-U-N-T-N-E-Y. Jim writes, by the way, the opera is out of copyright, but as David Putney is still alive, his translation is not, hence the credit. The translation doesn't expire until 70 years after the originator's death, and translations count as original works, even if they're a work that's out of copyright. The book, The Novelization of Modern Undead, is also dedicated to Keith Shand. Jim credits Simon Gurrier and Colin Brockhurst for this explanation, but Keith Shand was a literary editor and Grimwade's partner in the house seen in Grimwade's Mythmakers interview, clips on the DVDs. Jim says the only reference I can find is a book of literary criticism that he co-edited called 19th Century Suspense, From Poe to Conan Doyle, Macmillan, 1988. Keith Shand died 1 year after Peter Grimwade. Coming up after the break, Stephen B. from the New to Who podcast. We are going to talk Modern Undead. We are going to talk a very, very fun appearance that I had on a very, very good podcast called The Nymon Be Praised. I appeared on that show about 2 years ago, and we discussed all things Season 20. Different members of the panel had different opinions about different Season 20 stories. One of the co-hosts and I almost came to metaphorical blows over the fact that I liked King's Demons and nobody else does. When it came to Modern Undead, though, we were all reading from the same page. Just an excellent story. And Stephen B. and I are going to spend a lot of time saying very positive things about Modern, the scripts, Modern, the TV production, and Modern Undead, the novelization. Jim Sangster also points out that Modern is derived from the Welsh expression Marudin for dead man, which means the episode is really called Dead Man Undead. Let's get to it.
Are you ready to travel through time with us? Then check out Traveling the Vortex, a Doctor Who podcast. For nearly 7 years and more than 500 episodes, we've traveled from one end of the vortex to the other, making different stops with different doctors, reviewing everything from TV stories to audio plays, from books to comics, and more. Sean, Keith, and Glenn take you on a journey through 50-plus years of Doctor Who episodes and spinoff materials. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, so be sure to check us out. And now, we're a proud member of Direction Point, a Doctor Who podcast network. You're listening to the Doctor Who Literature Podcast.
So, my next guest has not been on the show for quite some time. Very happy to have you back. Stephen B. from the New to Who Podcast. How are you, sir?
Very well, Jason. Thank you for inviting me back. It's such a privilege and pleasure, not least to listen to you every Monday morning as I walk around Singapore and sometimes Sydney and sometimes around. So what a treat. Thank you.
You were a man of multiple time zones.
Unfortunately so. Yeah, jet lag can play a part in my life, it has to be said.
What part of the world are you broadcasting from right now?
Back in Singapore, yes. I was in Sydney for a good few months there during the autumn, but I'm back in Singapore now. Sunny Singapore.
So we are on opposite sides of the world. We are exactly 12 mm-hmm. hours apart time-wise as we record this.
Yeah. I mean, it could be worse, but 12 hours is a bit of a challenge. So again, I appreciate you having me on.
So speaking of time zones, the last time that we had you on the show was way back in episode 41 for Tomb of the Cybermen. And we have now doubled the number of target books. We've gone from the 41st book to the 82nd book, and we've jumped ahead more than 15 years. We've bypassed the 70s entirely, and we are now in season 20, the anniversary season, and we've gone to full color video. So much has changed in the worlds of Doctor Who since last we spoke.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like wonderful to hear your origin story. You've mentioned it recently again on the pod, but how the Davison era is very much your era, because this is the era of the show, particularly season 20, which I've heard you talk about before on Hamster, which sort of made you a fan, right? And I love that that's your story, because Davison actually has a big part in my story as well. Not necessarily my origins, but it was one of those things where between Tom Baker finishing on television in the early 90s here, there was a hiatus of around about a year or two. And that's when I became a super hardcore fan. And it's also when I basically read all of the targets and started to reach out into the 80s. And that's, the Davison era in terms of the target novelizations. And then when Castrovalva started, I was obviously just, a massive fan. But this is kind of the era of Doctor Who for me, the Davison era of Doctor Who for me, that kind of signals my deep, hardcore fandom, I guess, and is also an era that even to this day still manages to sort of have this shine of the newness about it, because the Davison era was so unknown to me, and it was, one of those things that sort of marked as I was going into high school as well, I guess, that sort of adolescent period of my life where I was, striking out, learning about the world, and that was part of that journey, I guess. So the Davison era is hugely important to me, and I've said before on the Doctor Who podcast, he was my doctor, not initially because that was Tom Baker, but my doctor out of choice when I was a teenager. Very much was able to identify with him in his era.
No, it's great to hear you say that, because like you say, the Davison era is where I came in. And this is a great time on the podcast, because this is the middle of a 10-week stretch of books where it's all Peter Davison. Books 76 through 85 are all out of the Davison era. And then after that, they start going back in time and producing a lot more novelizations from 1960s stories that never got printed. But for now, we're in the middle of this great Peter Davison run, and I've had a great lineup of guests to go with it. Speaking of guests, is there any further word from your podcast, New to Who?
I can actually reveal that we, a little while ago, recorded an episode on Mordred and Undead. It's sitting in the archive somewhere. I don't know when it will be released, if it will be released. It was one of those things that we sort of did, I think it was during even the COVID period. So it might be a bit messy to edit, but that's out there. And perhaps one day it will sort of, see the light of day. But at the moment, I guess we're kind of on hiatus. We've all got different things going on. Dan's had a little kid. Colin's got a lot going on, and as do I guess, with work and being in Singapore. So it makes it a bit difficult. There is no doubt in my mind that we'll all sit down and record again in the same room after, beer and pizza and watching an old crappy classic Doctor Who. But I just don't know when that might be. Apologies for that, sweet dorks who are listening, but I guess we will be back at some point.
Well, I hope you guys come back. You would, speaking of podcasts that we haven't heard from in a while, you had mentioned an episode that I did about season 20 on somebody else's show. That was not Hamster with a Blunt Penknife. I haven't done
it was Nylon.
Right, it was the Nymon Be Praised, which I don't believe that's active. Right. I haven't had that show up in my podcast feed in a long time, but I had done an episode two summers ago, so summer of 2021. So we talked about season 20, and I was in the role of defending season 20, and then Jack and Joe were in the role of prosecuting season 20. So we ended up nearly coming to fisticuffs.
You had the more difficult job overall, to be fair, but I do think Mordron is one of the better stories in season 20. I think Snake Dance and particularly Enlightenment are stellar Doctor Who, absolutely wonderful. But Mordron's kind of one of those episodes, or stories rather, that maybe doesn't get the credit that it deserves just in terms of how clever it is. And I think also just, you know, the fact that you've got the Brigadier in there and, you know, I think Tegan's on top form in particular as well. I think it's probably one of those stories that probably needs a bit of a revision in terms of its opinion.
I mean, in terms of negativity, it's very easy. There's a lot of people of a certain age that you mentioned the Peter Davison era to them, and they immediately go negative, whether they don't like the performance of the lead actor, or they don't like the era of, or the tone of the Eric Saward era, I should say, or they don't like individual stories because of choices made in production. That's why I was happy to take on the role of defender of season 20. And there was, I'm not going to say the entire podcast was negative. There was a pretty good consensus that everyone loves Enlightenment. A lot of people like Snake Dance. So there are stories there that everybody can be on the same page about. But reflexively, people seem to detest Arc of Infinity. Reflexively, people seem to detest Terminus. Reflexively, people seem to detest King's Demons for reasons I cannot figure out. So if you take on the role of defending, or as I would say, celebrating those stories, you do get a lot of pushback, even to this day, 40 years later. Again, it's very easy to shoot fish in a barrel. It's very easy to say, oh, this was made 40 years ago, so therefore it has no merit. But if that's going to be your default approach, why are we even Doctor Who fans? Because the whole era is archival.
Yeah, it's exactly so.
I think it's important to defend stories that nobody else likes. Now, again, there are stories that I really, really dislike, and I will happily talk about them. And for those of you who are eagle-eared listeners, yes, The Dominators is coming up very soon on this podcast, and I'm fully expecting fireworks and dramatics. That being said, one of the things that I learned during my rewatch in 2020 and 2021 is that every classic Who story is my favorite for some small moment of time. Like, take Android Invasion. Please take Android Invasion, as the man says. The first part of that is really, really good. I really enjoy Android Invasion. And there are isolated moments of the Dominators. If you cut it down to 60-second segments, there are some 60-second clips that are really, really funny and worth praising. So I can find the good to say in just about any classic series story, with the possible exception of a couple like Survival or Abominable Snowman. But for the most part, I try and be positive here. So while you and I can agree that some people don't like parts of season 20, I think Mordron Undead is one of the highlights.
Oh, I think so too. And whether it's retrospectively applied or not, this idea that season 20 is a celebration and we do have, you know, past friends and foes coming from, you know, the show's past back into, you know, the stories of then modern times, I think it's a lovely way of sort of marking that 20th anniversary as well. And, you know, having the Brigadier back, I know that William Russell was meant to be, you know, the character at the school. And I know that afterwards they actually, you know, went to Ian Marder before they actually went to Nicholas Courtney. But the way that Nicholas Courtney plays that, and in fact, the way that the Brigadier fits in to the thematic sort of aspects of the story, you know, the sort of, you know, old soldier who's, you know, had his time and now it's passed and is suffering effectively like a complex PTSD from it. It's so moving and so beautiful, and it's captured wonderfully on screen, particularly through that famous montage, but even also, and probably talk about this later on, through Grimwade's prose as well. I think it's just, absolutely wonderful. And to me, that's kind of comfort Doctor Who in many ways, those Davison-era stories that have those throwbacks to the past, perhaps, or create their own mythology. I think it's a sort of, yeah, beautiful and, again, very sort of personal sweet spot of Doctor Who for me, classic Doctor Who for me.
Yeah, I want to talk about that montage at length, and I'm going to play it a little bit later on during the program because it'll come up when I do my audio essay about the novelization. But you have all right, Peter Moffat is the director, and he was doing one or two stories a year, and he was very reliable as a guy who could finish on time and under budget. But the knock on Peter Moffat, and this has come up quite a bit because we are deeply in the Peter Moffat era on my show, going back to State of Decay. And the episodes before this were centered around the Five Doctors, which Peter Moffat also directed. There are moments in Modern Undead where I think his direction does not serve the story. Like the moment where the Doctor looks up and there's Turlo for the first time on the opposite side of the TARDIS console. It should be a great moment where the actors look up simultaneously and hold a look. Moffat cuts away from that so fast that there's no reaction. Nicholas Courtney on location says, "Take it from me, boy. Objects can't just dematerialize out of thin air." That is begging for a close-up and a sting on the soundtrack, but because there was no close-up, I don't think Patty Kingsland could even get around to it on the soundtrack. Now, again, you could say that on location, you don't have the time to set up close-ups, but other stories have been able to do close-ups on location, specifically Peter Grimwade and Legopolis, to pick a story of recent vintage. So those are problems with the story. These are moments that should be terrific, which Peter Moffat undersells by just playing them as moments of no particular import. That being said, the script is strong, and it certainly shows up in the novelization. And then you have Patty Kingsland's score. I mean, rock guitar on an eternal alien spaceship. And again, coming back to the montage, he plays a rock and roll version of the Doctor Who theme under that Brigadier montage. Is that not the most beautiful thing ever?
I tend to agree with you. There's definitely, I guess the visuals could very much be improved. And, you know, Moffat, we know it's Peter Moffat, what we're going to get with him. And it is, as you say, reliable, and it gets in the can and it's done. But it's kind of, you know, he's probably not as bad as Ron Jones, but there's this class of directors in the 80s that sort of come around quite frequently. They do the job and, you know, there's no bells and whistles and we get the show and that's it. And then there's others that sort of come along and, you know, I don't want to mention any names perhaps, but you know, there's far more dynamic directors perhaps in the 80s as well, and so as a result of that, the Peter Moffat school of directing sort of comes off a lot poorer. But Paddy Kingsland, I'm a big fan of Paddy Kingsland. Castrovalva is one of my absolute favourites. I did a hamster commentary with Joe where we actually side by side paralleled the Tarkin novelization with the televised story. And, you know, Paddy Kingsland is such an important part and such a memorable part of that story for me. I don't know if this score is quite as good as the Castrovalva one, but there are moments. And again, you know, we were talking before about Doctor Who having moments and each story having moments. One of those for me, I guess, in this story is that beautiful weeping guitar that he sort of plays. I think when we have the 19, is it the 83 or the 77 Brigadier? But it's kind of his theme, and it sort of occurs every now and then, and it's just a beautiful, haunting, just sort of musical cue. But again, it stands very much at contrast with that sort of, as you say, space rock guitar, which just comes out of nowhere, and it's just like, really, we're doing this? So it's a really jagged and sort of uneven production, I think. But that doesn't mean that it's rubbish. It just means that it probably encapsulates, in fact, the best things and the worst things about Davison's era in one go. And I think I sort of mentioned this on the yet-to-be-broadcast episode of New to Who around Modern Undead. It's probably the most archetypal Davison story in that regard. If you were to sort of look at a story that, you know, best encapsulates the production values and the you know, the themes and the characterization, the callback to the past, the sort of timey-wimeyness of it, I guess, as well sort of adds to that sort of stay-with-ease techno-babble that we have as well. It's just so typical of the Davison era, I think, and there's a lot to celebrate, but also there's a lot of, you know, duff notes that it hits as well, I think.
So there's a lot to talk about there. So you did the hamster for Castor Valva. That's incredible because the very last hamster that I did, and this is 2 years ago now, was Legopolis.
Yeah, I remember that.
If someone is going to listen to the show in hamster order and just watch the hamsters from Unearthly all the way to Survival, you and I will be back to back with Legopolis and Valva.
I like the symmetry of that. Wonderful.
Now, this is a long time ago. I probably had the novelization now, because as I mentioned, Legopolis is my all-time favorite novelization ever. So I know I would have talked about it on that show 2 years ago, but at the same time, we almost certainly would have talked about the Patty Kingsland score. When I was in law school, my first year of law school, this is a true story. My kid doesn't believe me. I had no television. So there was a full 12-month period in the mid-1990s where I went an entire living by myself in the upper Midwest in the U.S. without a TV. So one of my friends sat there with an audio cassette recorder in front of his TV, and he watched all the way through Legopolis and all the way through Castor Valva, and he taped only the scenes that had Patty Kingsland's score underneath. So I would play these tapes over and over again that year in law school when I had no television. It was most of Castor Valva, most of Legopolis. I was going to say Fort of Doomsday, but Fort of Doomsday is not a score you can listen to because Roger Lynn is another one of the negative marks against Peter Davis and Nero. But just listening to that score, the two of them over and over again, I can probably hum most of the Legopolis and Castor Valva scores. And if you play me the isolated soundtrack, I can probably tell you the dialogue that goes over it. It's the same with Brilliant. John Williams' theme to Superman the movie. I can tell you random bits of the opening titles of Superman the movie. If you play me a 10-second bit of the audio from the John Williams score, I can tell you whose name flies through space over the opening credits. Oh, this is Jack Halloran's name.
No
the opening
way.
Credits. This is Margot Kidder.
Wow.
Now, I haven't tried to do that in a long time, but it's a thing that I could do. Same with Patty Kingsland's score for those two stories. So yeah, Patty Kingsland, definitely big thumbs up. Now, I think it's dangerous to criticize a story because of its direction, okay? A script doesn't pick its director for the most part. You can't blame a story just because Ron Jones happened to be assigned to it. This has come up on this podcast recently as well, but John Nathan Turner had a lot of trouble in season 18 with Lovett Bickford and Paul Joyce. Fabulous directors. But they went over budget, they went over time, and I think JNT, who probably got into a lot of trouble with his bosses in his very first year on the show, probably needed directors that he could trust who were never going to go over time or budget. Enter Ron Jones. Ron Jones does not seem to be aware that cameras can move, okay? Ron Jones is not aware that you can pan. Ron Jones is not aware that you can zoom. Ron Jones has never heard of the words tracking shot. When you watch a Ron Jones story, it is an exercise in frustration because you want the camera to move, all right? This is not an episode of All My Children where the camera stays in one place and the actors do a 5-minute two-hander scene arguing about, you know, their relationship. You want the camera to move in a science fiction story. Lovett Bickford definitely knew how to do that. Paul Joyce definitely knew how to do that. For the directors that stayed, Fiona Cumming definitely knew how to do that. But Doctor Who lost a lot after season 13 because Douglas Canfield leaves the show. After season 14, you never see David Maloney again. You never see Rodney Bennett again. A lot of the all-time great directors leave the show starting in the late 70s, so JNT does not have this pool of great directors to fall back on. And when he finds great new young directors, he can't use them because he's shooting to his schedule and they can't keep it. So I'm not going to dislike a story only because Pennant Roberts is directing it. See of the Deep Comma Warriors. The things that we can praise about Modron Undead have nothing to do with Peter Moffat, and it's not just Patty Kingsland's score. This is a great script. Peter Grimwade, I'm a big fan of his as a director and as a writer. And again, we've had people fighting over time flight on this show. Not everyone thinks that Peter Grimwade is a terrific writer. I happen to love his scripts and his books. You have Mark Strickson. One of the best things about Doctor Who in the 1980s, you have Valentine Dial only in it for about 8 minutes of screen time, but every single line of dialogue that he utters is just endlessly repeatable. You have Angus MacKay. We're going to hear from Angus MacKay a little bit later. you have Stephen Garlick, who had been the lead in The Dark Crystal a few years earlier. He is in a too small part playing Turlough's school friend. David Collings, who was in a terrific number of Doctor Who stories in the 70s and 80s. Revenge of the Cybermen gave a great performance. Robots of Death gave a great performance. He's excellent here. So if you just criticize the director, you're missing the forest because there are too many darn trees in the way. Am I right?
I completely agree. Absolutely. And as you say, there's so many things about this story, whether it's on screen or actually just, you know, the words on a page, the script, and as it's brought to life in terms of the novelization by Grimwade as well, that I think it's just, it's a lot better than people give it credit for. And maybe that's a bias on my part because I am so driven by the written word because, you know, like I say, that period between, you know, Tom Baker being on television and me becoming a fan and Davison coming back of about 2 years, you know, when I'm sort of, I don't know, 10, 11, 12, that's when I become a fan. And it's not through watching the television shows because they weren't on Australian TV at the time. It's through just deep diving into the targets and just consuming dozens of them in that 2 year period. So I agree. As a result of that, and I probably do have to acknowledge my bias, the story itself and the plot beats and the characterization too, I just think it sings in this particular case. There's so many, you know, what I call grace notes, particularly in the novelization that Grimwade gives to a lot of the, I guess, the interiority of the characters. You know, wonderful little sort of similes that he uses to help them make sense of the events of the narrative. I think you're right. I think it's you have to look at it in terms of a story, and this is a target book podcast. I think on those grounds at least, it's a lot better than people think it is.
Yeah, I'll have a lot more to say about the novelization when I do my audio essay, but it's a very funny book. There are lots of wicked character insights in this one, and then in Planet of Fire, which is coming up on this show in 2 or 3 months. He's a very funny writer, and again, it's a short book. It's 119 pages. He's not going to have time to write the great American novel. Well, I guess by definition, he'd not be able to write the great American novel, but... he doesn't have time to write a 500-page soaring epic into the human soul. He's not writing Dance to the Music of Time. He has 119 pages to tell, you know, a 90-page TV script. So he has to use a lot of shorthand. There are certain things that he has to sort of gloss over. With that being said, it's very funny how he talks about the Brigadiers being short of breath, going up and down that hill multiple times in a day. He has some very amusing asides from the point of view of the Brigadier and Turlough talking about Ibbotson. The Doctor's and Tegan's and Nissa's thoughts while they're on Modron's ship, very, very funny. And the vocabulary is terrific too. So I was just listening to an episode of the Doctor Who Target Book Club podcast. I'm about 6 or 7 weeks behind, so I'm just getting to their episode on Time Flight. And the panel there was not very fond of the Time Flight novelization, again, because it's very short and has to not delve into certain things that you could if it was a 500-page book. I just think that Grimwade is underrated as a writer, and he passed away, unfortunately, very young, so we never got to see what else he could do. But I think these books are a pretty good legacy for him to leave behind.
Yeah, I think so. And even with Time Flight, as you say, I think part one is eminently watchable, even as a production, but particularly just the target novelization. It's such a wonderful idea, a Concorde, you know, faster than sound, you know, commercial jetliner goes, you know, back into the past and into, you know, Jurassic times. I think that's a great idea for a story. Now, the rest of it may not necessarily follow in terms of, you know, how the, you know, the Doctor and the Masters, you know, fight, you know, is resolved effectively by handing over some technology between them. You know, that's not very good, I agree. But, you know, the ideas are there, and the ideas are here as well. And, you know, what you said before about the way that Grimwade offers insights into the characters and, you know, some scorchingly funny and, you know, really clever asides, I guess, that sort of run to the interiority of the characters, I think is sort of testament to a writer who probably is underrated. You know, there's those examples of, you know, as you say, when they're on the red ship, as he calls it in the novelization, And, you know, Davison's doctor discovers tons of, you know, he has the a homeowner discovering dry rot. And it's just superbly ridiculous. But then that's sort of counterposed against, you know, these beautiful moments. You know, I mentioned the Brigadier flashback sequence, which is super beautiful. But it's even more isolated than that. Every now and then he'll strike a grace note. And there's one where, you know, the doctor sort of realizes, oh, I might be trapped here in 1983. The TARDIS is in 1977. There's no way for me to get it back. And, you know, he looks out over this beautiful vista and, you know, it's one of those ambitions in life, I guess, where one day I'll go yomping up that hill and, you know, to the obelisks and sort of pay my, you know, do a pilgrimage and pay my Doctor Who dues there. But there's that sort of beautiful English country scene and Grimwade's comment is, you know, taking all of this in, the doctor says, you know, as beautiful as this is, nowhere in the universe, however beautiful, you know, it loses its charm when it becomes a place of exile. And that's also obviously a very beautiful callback to Pertwee's exile on Earth and that story of the exile finding a home in his place of exile, you know, which ties in thematically again with the Brigadier's era of UNIT and the Pertwee era. So I think, again, you know, talking in a roundabout way, I guess, but there's all these little surprises and gems in Grimwade's writing, whether that's, you know, actually visualized on the television screen, you know, and that a lot of it obviously is mediated through people like Peter Moffat, or whether it's just actually the script itself and the way that the novelization sort of conveys that. Yeah, I'm a big fan. I think there's a lot here.
I'll give you a couple of examples from the prose. These are lines that made me laugh out loud, even when I was 12, 13 years old. And these are examples that I'm not using later on in the audio essay. So this is page 12. Turlough has been involved in a motor vehicle accident and he's confined to the public school sickbay. The matron, Miss Cassidy, is given a name and dialogue. She features rather heavily in the novelization in a way that she doesn't on television. Page 12. Turlough had no intention of submitting to the dictatorial old harridan. I'm not going to bed. Matron regarded the boy as a sergeant major might some young recruit who has just said he would really rather not get his hair cut, nor would her voice have been out of place on the parade ground. You can draw a picture of this lady just from those two paragraphs.
Okay? Absolutely, yeah. That's wonderful. That's a really great example. Absolutely, yeah.
And here's another one, bottom of page 15. Tegan, and I'm not going to do the Australian accent, I mean, it's more like a Queen Mary than a spaceship. They were whispering, like children from the village who had wandered, uninvited, into the big house. But no starched parlor maid rushed forward to ask them their business. That's really funny.
Yeah. I think it's also in that scene where Nyssa talks about, you know, the ship being built for pleasure, and there's a sort of a Calvinistic disapproval in her tone of voice.
Yeah, exactly. Right, right. This is a comedy of manners hidden inside of a science fiction story about an immortal.
Yeah, exactly.
You do this up as a Star Trek novelization, and nobody's putting in asides about dictatorial old harridans and starched parlor maids and Calvinistic attitudes.
The harridan line, though, it just puts me in mind of Bob Holmes, right? And I wonder how much Grimwade sort of imbibed the mythos of classic Doctor Who, because, you know, obviously he sort of calls back to things like Legopolis, but then there's a mention to the Zero Room, which is, you know, he's got nothing to do with Castrovalva whatsoever. He doesn't direct it. He's not involved in the scripting of that or whatever, but that's there as well. I wonder whether there's an element of Grimwade being a bit of a fan, or at least coming to be a bit of a fan through his involvement in the show.
If you read Legopolis not just as one random story made at the end of season 18, but if you look at it as part of the Doctor Who mythology, it talks an awful lot about unearthly child. It's the first time we hear the expression Totter's Yard since 1963, and we hear a lot about the chameleon circuit. Grimwade must have been a fan, and you're right. Robert Holmes had this great line on insults. If you watch any Hinchcliffe-era Robert Holmes story, just write down the insults that characters say to one another. Some of the best ones come from Brain of Morbius, but Morbius refers yes. to the head of the Sisterhood as a palsied Harridan.
Palsied Harridan, that's right.
And then also the he calls them a squalid brood of harpies. Now, I don't know if you were a Mad Magazine guy growing up. I was raised in a Mad Magazine household in the early 80s. So
okay.
Annie was my first Broadway musical. Probably 1980 I saw it on Broadway. Alison Smith played okay. Annie. She had a long career, but you know, not an A-list superstar. But she was Annie, and I think I saw Albert Finney as – it was either Albert Finney or Harve Presnell. One was in the movie version and one was I saw on Broadway. But when the movie came out in 82 or 83, Mad Magazine did a parody of Annie the Musical, the movie. And the character okay. played by Carol Burnett is called Miss Harridan in the Mad Magazine parody because she is. So I learned that word from Mad Magazine, and when it shows up in a Doctor Who novelization a few years later, I know that word. That comes from Mad Magazine. But Grimway must have gotten it from Robert Holmes instead.
I think it's likely. It's just one of those immortal lines, and as you say, for a brain of Morb is the paws at Harrod, and it's a brilliant Bob Holmes insult. It's wonderful.
Yeah, so you can definitely do a reading of Peter Grimway to see him as a big fan of certain eras of the show, that's for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Go on.
Nicholas Courtney. Well, finish your thought, and then I want to talk about Nicholas Courtney, because we have not talked about him enough.
No, it's true. We haven't. But just to sort of, before we head off away from Grimwade, I think not only is he, very possibly, a bit of a fan of the show, but he's also quite well read. You know, we've got some wonderful allusions to the Flying Dutchman myth, which really intrigued me because reading the stanza from the libretto as part of the epigraph there of the novelization just sort of sent me into the library. And I wanted to know more about the Flying Dutchman. And, obviously the whole Mordrin subplot is very much based on the myth of the Flying Dutchman, where, in the original, every 7 years, the ship will float around on the seven seas, but every 7 years, it'll be able to come into port and seek redemption. And this is obviously sort of transposed to every 70 years, the Red Ship, as it's called in the novelization, brings it within, striking distance, I guess, of the planet, and one of the fools are able to sort of go down and seek support to sort of end their eternal torment. And it's one of those sort of things that we see it again, I guess, in the Five Doctors, where immortality is a curse, and when the gods wish to punish us, they answer our prayers, and all of that thing about, I guess, Apollo granting to I think it's the Sibyl at Cumae immortality, but neglecting his reputation for sadism, forgot to ask for eternal youth at the same time. And so she just becomes increasingly decrepit and is unable to die because she's got immortality. And then that sort of resurfaces in the epigraph to The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot, where these boys who come to see and taunt the Sibyl ask her, what do you want, Sibyl? I guess sort of evoking Apollo's question to her. And this time she says, I want to die, which is, of course, exactly the plot here around Mordrin and his fellow sort of, conspirators. They've endured such a torment and realized, I guess, the errors of their ways around immortality and now want nothing to do with it. Anyway, it's a bit of a sort of sidetrack through literary history, perhaps. But all of those themes are there and they resonate. And you can sort of, pick that up, I think, in terms of Grimwade's thematics and even the way that he plots it as well. Just really clever, I think.
Yeah, those are really good points about Flying Dutchman. Obviously, when I'm 12 years old, I would not have heard any Wagner or any opera. And given Wagner's reputation for being a world-class anti-Semite, he's not somebody that I
particularly want to explore. Oh, that's true. Yeah, no, I only know from Wagner, obviously from the novelization, the lines that are included in the epigraph, but also Looney Tunes. So there's a lot of Wagner in the Bugs Bunny cartoons. other than that, I'm true. a bit of a Philistine, I'm afraid.
When my daughter was a toddler, we used to take her to a play space in Brooklyn, and this it was a 40-foot jungle gym built into the side of the of the business, and it was just a great place to go. We had one of her birthday parties there. But on the wall of the building, leading back from the play space to the party area, they had all these inspirational quotes painted on the wall. And one of the inspirational quotes was by was by Wagner. I'm like, is that really the guy who you want to have an inspirational quote on the wall of your business in Brooklyn, New York? And the owners didn't quite realize what they were doing. They just saw a great quote in the book and decided to copy it out without realizing who said it.
That is absurd.
But it's an iconic story, and it's a great story to bring into the Doctor Who universe. I mean, Doctor Who is at its best when it's taking other movies, like in the Hinchcliffe era, and turning them into Doctor Who episodes. So regardless of who Wagner was and what he thought, turning this opera into Doctor Who is great. Works for me.
Yeah. And, it predates Wagner anyway. You know, it's a myth that sort of isn't sort of spawned necessarily by Wagner's imagination. But, it's very much tied to him, I guess. But, it's what Doctor Who does best. I'll say that again. It's a family show that's sort of very much aimed at the kids within the family, that has the family watching. And so as a result of that, there's that sort of Reithian instruction aspect about it as well, where you want to be able to sort of educate these kids in some way through entertainment. And one of the ways to do that is to take myths of, from the Greek, from wherever, from literature, from, Hammer horror, rather, films, as you say, the Hinchcliffe era and, classic old Hollywood, and bring them into a digestible, familiar format so that kids are then able to sort of become familiar with it. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily that, everyone's going to walk away from, having seen Mordred and Undead being, 12-year-old experts on The Flying Dutchman, but it means that you start to recognize these tropes, or you start to recognize these characters' motifs, so that when you do come across it later in life, or, other texts or whatever, you start to say, oh, hang on a second, that rings a bell. And I think that's what Doctor Who does really particularly well, I think, for that. What did Bob Holmes, or was it Philip Hinchcliffe, say that the smart 12-year-old or the smart 14-year-old, that's the sort of demographic that they were aiming at? I think that's absolutely one of the Doctor Who.
Yeah, I mean, just looking to the Tom Baker era, you have Underworld and Horns of Nymon are both directly based on Greek mythology, and they both give shout-outs to it. And you can learn a lot as a kid from that, even if those two stories also take a lot of criticism for the way they are directed and or acted. But again, I don't blame the stories for who directs them. I think those are both very witty scripts. Underworld is difficult to sit through. Horns of Nymon I can watch over and over again and never get tired of. But Doctor Who is best when it takes these old myths or great stories and puts a spin on them. I've been watching a lot of Hammer Horror this week because tomorrow I'm doing an episode of somebody else's podcast about Tomb of the Cybermen. So I went back to the Discontinuity Guide and I read the Roots section of the Discontinuity Guide entry on Tomb. Two Hammer Horror movies, both of which star an actor in Tomb of the Cybermen, and the Avengers episode, The House That Jack Built.
Jack Built, yes.
I've been doing – and that – the house has a lot of resemblance to a very specific room inside the Tomb of the Cybermen. So I'm not positive that it's really a direct influence on the production team, but there's definitely a lot of rhyming and similarity to the set design.
Yeah, and it's all the same context, right? We're talking about that sort of 1960s British cult sci-fi kind of genre, and it's all, all influenced by one another, whether it's people behind the scenes or actually in front of the camera, as you say, sharing credits across those shows and films. So I think you're right. I think that's all in the ether at that point in time, definitely.
So Mordred Undead benefits from this background. And speaking of background, you have over your right shoulder two M.C. Escher prints.
I do. This is how much of a Castrovalva tragic I am. It's Relativity, which obviously inspires the sort of recursive occlusion aspect of Castrovalva, and the other print is actually of Castrovalva itself, the mountaintop Italian village where I actually pilgrimaged to in around about 2016, I think it was. Got a flat tire on the way back. Nonetheless, it was worth it to be able to sort of sit at those gates and look out over the same valley view that Escher did, over 100 years previously. But again, this is how tragic I am, I guess, and how influenced I am by particularly that period of Davison and target novelizations in that sort of period that I described, I guess. And that they are both Escher prints on my wall. I have to admit that.
Are the residents of Castrovalva aware that Doctor Who set an episode in a planet named after their city? And is there any Doctor Who merchandise to be had in the village of Castrovalva?
No, there isn't. They're familiar with Escher. There's not very many people there. They're familiar with Escher, but there's absolutely no because Escher lived there for a little while. You know, he sort of came to visit in the middle of the night. They tell the story of how he sort of appeared and it was raining and they thought he was a spy. but no knowledge of Doctor Who, I guess, in the Italian-speaking world, which makes sense.
So let's turn then to Nicholas Courtney. I was reading my tweets on Modron from 2 years ago during my pilgrimage.
Yeah. Okay, yep.
I happened to watch a little bit of part one on Pluto TV because they run through most of Doctor Who every 5 days. So if you turn it on, odds are you're going to see a bit of a good story. So like last night I watched a little bit of Invasion of the Dinosaurs part three, underrated story. Last week was completely a little bit of Modron Undead part one, underrated story. So what I said in my tweet 2 years ago is that Nicholas Courtney was 45 when he was last a regular on the show. We last saw him in Terror of the Zygons, which was the last story produced as part of season 12, even though it was aired in season 13. So he'd been a regular or semi-regular on the show for six seasons, 7 through 12. Then he had been a guest star in the two different seasons before that, one in season 5, one in season 6. So we watch him go from a very slim, athletic young man in his late 30s. And by the time of his last story, he's starting to fill out a little bit. He's in his mid-40s now, 45 years old. Now we don't see him for 7 years. Now he shows up after last being seen in season 12. Here he is now in season 20. And he's much larger, and he has gray hair, which is happening to me in real time as well. I'm kind of equidistant between Terror of the Zygons Courtney and Modron Undead Nicholas Courtney. But he's giving two different performances in the same story, and it's a level of acting that he wasn't required to do for most of his run on the show. How do you think he handles playing the young, vibrant 1977 Brigadier and the old, graying, as you say, complex PTSD Brigadier? He's the same age, and makeup helps us tell them apart, but he's giving two performances of two characters in different ages and different points of their life in the same six-day shoot. I think that's pretty incredible.
I think it is incredible, but it also speaks, I guess, to the as a testament to his chops as an actor, and maybe even that generation of actors as well. He has that wonderful stentorious voice, which is still with him, and probably even sort of deepens as he gets older. And that's very much, I guess, evident here as well. What I particularly like about it is that there's a fragility in that 1983 Doctor that he's able to convey that isn't there in the 1977 one, obviously, because it doesn't need to be. And the sort of sensitive treatment of, I guess, what is a mental health issue, seeing someone struggle through that, it's incredible. Like, it's a wonderful portrayal, and it's a wonderful performance by Nick Courtney. Just one of his best, I think, in the series, because he's given that emotional stuff to do rather than five rounds rapid sort of stuff that perhaps he was given a lot to do in the Pertwee years, and he rises to it.
And again, it would have been wonderful to have William Russell in the role. I mean, that's the whole reason why the character is a math teacher at a British public school. Would have been great to see Ian Martyr again, although he was busy writing the books at this time. But the way that Courtney plays it, the Brigadier of 1977, and Grimway does this in the novelization as well, is a character you're terrified of because he's, a former military figure. And that makes it much more stark that he's suffering from PTSD in 1983. I think the story probably works better because you would never be afraid of Ian Chesterton in 1977. You would never be afraid of Harry Sullivan, but you would be afraid of the Brigadier. That makes the story work that much better.
Yeah, and there's something cruel about bringing back characters who we haven't seen for a long time and putting them in that sort of situation. as if to say, well, you know, their life has got really worse after leaving the Doctor. And here, maybe it's because we've had that sort of extended history with them. And obviously Nick Courtney as an actor as well, but there's so much pathos about that characterization, you know, and he has those moments. He talks about, you know, this one goes until he drops, and there's that sort of almost impotent rage and shaking in his, you know, sad decline. And that, yeah, just, you know, I just find it really touching, and there's an emotional depth there in that performance. And maybe that's more fitting of a character that we're probably, if not more familiar with, than sort of over that longer period of time, as you say, from season five onwards, like there's more of an ability to connect, perhaps, and have that sort of sympathetic response. Because everyone, even in 1983, I guess, would have recognized Nick Courtney as the Brigadier. Would they necessarily recognize, you know, William Russell as Ian Chesterton, or, you know, Ian Marder as Harry Sullivan? I'm not sure, and I'm not sure if that impact and that pathos would be there as a result. So it's by accident. Now, I understand he was third choice, but it's probably the right character to use in this story.
And it helps that the Brigadier comes back three more times after this. We see him again in Five Doctors. We see him again in a major role in Battlefield in the final season. And he also had that stealth cameo in Silver Nemesis. So it helps that he comes back to the show again and again, and we see that he gets over this and his life wasn't really ruined.
Yeah, great point.
Even the amnesiac Brigadier in the novelization, this is page 37, the Doctor's hand went to his face, which was once again wreathed in smiles. "Of course," he cried, "I'd forgotten, Brigadier. I'm into my fourth regeneration." The Brigadier's heart sank. They tangled with some fanatic, one of those born-again Johnnies by the sound of
born-again Johnnies.
"Excuse me," he murmured as politely as he could manage. That's a very funny line.
It's so good, isn't it? Yeah. But that's such a good point that you make, that because we see the Brigadier after this, we kind of are assured in some ways that, you know, he's okay. You know, he's not the sort of broken man that you know, we sort of see at, in Mordred and Undead for most of it anyway. You know, that there is that kind of, not redemption necessarily, but, you know, the assurance that later on he's back to his old self. And, you know, within a year in the Five Doctors, it's like he was never away. It's just.
And the idea of breaking the character in order to heal him again comes up in the books in the year 2000. Paul Cornell's Eighth Doctor novel,
The Shadows of Avalon. Yeah.
Which it begins with the Brigadier having experienced a personal tragedy, another one, and being in therapy and having long conversations with his therapist in the book, all so that in the end, he can get the job that the Brigadier was supposed to have taken at the end of Battlefield as a, you know, de facto male leader of an alien civilization. So this idea of Mordred Undead comes back in the books, in a book that had a pretty significant part in the then ongoing year 2000 story arc. So somebody was paying careful attention to this story, definitely.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. And you know who else is, I think, paying close attention to this story, particularly through its timey-wimey plot? I think this is the story that broke Stephen Moffat's brain. And when it healed afterwards, it was set in a particular way, which meant that he was only able to tell stories in a timey-wimey fashion, or at least a preponderance for that. Now, that's no bad thing. I'm a huge fan of Stephen Moffat, but there are so many aspects to this that I think, oh, right, we see how this is picked up on and expanded, or, you know, taken in another direction in the Moffat era. And, of course, you've got, Time Crash as well, where you've got the Davison Doctor meeting David Tennant's Doctor, and it's written by Stephen Moffat.
With the reference to Tegan and Nyssa and the Master, yes.
Exactly. And it is a whole Blinovich limitation effect plot, basically, that little skit.
Yeah, when I was watching that random bit of Invasion of the Dinosaurs on Pluto TV last night, I caught the reference to the Blinovich limitation effect, and yeah. It's scripted so that Sarah interrupts the Doctor. He never gets to define it. But the novelization gave us a definition, which is very similar to the one that's given here.
Yeah. No, I like that. I like that it wasn't sort of necessarily locked down. But if you've read Barry Letts's autobiography, he sort of uses that as a way to sort of point to it being a hard stop on how you can go about just basically cheating in time travel stories. Because, of course, if you've got a time machine, you can go back and do whatever you want and undo any kinds of damage. But there's no dramatic, feasibility in telling that kind of story. So he uses it as a bit of a hard stop to say, look, you know, we can't have people going back and crossing over their own timelines, as you probably do in Back to the Future, for instance.
Yeah, and Stephen Moffat was definitely a little bit of a magpie. You can look at some mm-hmm. of the old stories and some of the books and see pieces that he is quoting directly, like the planet-wide university in Terrence Dix's Shakedown almost certainly has to have some influence on the planet-wide library in Silence in the Library. Yeah. And if you read Craig Hinton's Quantum Archangel, the first half of which is a line-for-line sequel-slash-remake of The Time Monster. The second half of Quantum Archangel is basically Day of the Doctor, beat for beat, with characters of the same name and the same plot function, and the Doctor being war president of Gallifrey, fighting a Time War against the Daleks. I mean, Stephen Moffat must have been reading this stuff, because he contributed to the books, you know, in terms of the short stories. He must have been reading these books, and he must have saved the ideas and found a way to use them in a very grand sense. So, yeah, I can see this breaking the young Stephen Moffat's brain, saying, I must explore this further.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Anyway, but I think it's there. I think it's there.
Well, speaking of breaking brains, it is time, Stephen, to challenge you to a game of 20 questions.
Okay, I haven't prepared for this. Let's see how we go. Oh, gosh.
So you've been on this show before, you listen to the show once a week, you know the drill. I am one random Doctor Who story between 1963 and 2022, selected at random from therandomizer.net. Through 20 yes or no questions, you are going to guess which story I am. Many people have tried different approaches to win this game. There is the guess one random story with your first question and hope you get it in one for a mm-hmm. record that'll never be broken. There's the ask questions in chronological order. Jim Sangster asked the was it done in a 4:3 aspect ratio question. So you have many ways to play this game. Stephen, what is your first question?
Look, I'm going to have to do the Hail Mary just for the chance of immortality. Although, as we've seen today, immortality is a curse. Let's go with Vengeance on Varos.
Ooh, so your question number one is it Vengeance on Varos? And that's a very random guess. And if you were right, you would have been the all-time permanent winner of this show forever and ever. Unfortunately, no, I am not Vengeance on Varos, so we must move on to the prosaic. Question two.
I was prepared for that. Is it classic Who?
Yes, I am a classic Who story, somewhere between 1963 and 1989. Question three.
Okay. Are you black and white?
No, I am not a black and white story. So that eliminates the entirety of the 1960s. You are down to two decades of televised Who. Question four.
Okay. Am I 70s?
Do you mean aired in the 70s or produced in the 70s?
No, I think we have to go with air dates, don't we?
There is a little bit of an overlap. So just phrase that question in a slightly different way.
Okay. Is this a Doctor Who story that was televised in the 1970s?
No, the answer to that is no. And unfortunately, okay, that question may sort of narrow down the answer precipitously.
It does. And if I was on my game, I would probably be able to isolate this. But as it is, it's definitely going to be season 17, and it's going to be the tail end of season 17, isn't it?
So now you're at question five.
Okay, question five. And Conrad still got the record at six, right?
Actually, the crown went to Mark McManus, who got it in...
Oh, that's right, World with War the...
Five. A random guess Silver about Nemesis. Silver Nemesis, which happens to be his favorite story for reasons I can't quite fathom or endorse. I think you will have a share of the crown if you get it right now with question five.
Okay, well, people are screaming at me, aren't they, right now? And I'm wondering, for some reason, Horns of Nymon is what's
That is a very good
mind.
Guess, because Horns of Nymon was made in the 70s, but aired in 1980. Well, it actually crossed over. The first week was Christmas 79, and the rest of it was 1980. Mm. But no, the answer is not Horns of Nymon. That brings us to question six, and Mark McManus, your record is safe for the time being.
Yeah, it is safe. Okay. Now I've had a mental blank because I was so convinced it was Horns of Nymon.
You're on the right track. I will tell you that you're on the right track.
Okay. All right. A clarifying question. In amongst all of these stories that are loaded into the randomizer, is Sharda a potential and does it count towards the 20 questions game?
I'm going to count that as a actual question, so that's going to be your question six.
Fair enough.
Sharda is part of the randomizer, and you can thank or blame the guys from Flight to Entirety through that. The project is their child.
No, I'm sure that's Nathan absolutely and quite right, too.
Now we're on question seven.
Well, then it's got to be Sharda, doesn't it? Is it Sharda?
You might well think that, and in fact, yes, the answer is Sharda. Now, that's the reason... Ding, 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 you got it in seven. Very good. You're on the leaderboard. Sharda would have been...
With help.
They filmed it, and they did the first of the three planned studio blocks in 1979, but it always would have been aired in 1980, January or February, March 1980. So it was part of the 1979-80 season. It was made in the 70s. It looks 70s, but it never would have... Even if it had aired, it would not have aired in 1979. And bits of it aired in 83, and then it was released on video in the 90s, and then it was a big Finnish audio in the aughts, and then it was various animated versions. And they actually have it as part of the Pluto TV rotation, the hybrid live action slash animated reconstruction. So I watched a bit of Sharda a few nights ago.
Lovely. Yeah, no, I have a soft spot for Sharda, definitely. I think it's one of those... You know, its reputation has probably grown by the fact that it was always a lost story for a long time. But I still think it's really clever, and it's a shame we never got it in its original form. Happy to have it now, though.
I don't think we are ever covering Sharda on Doctor Who literature. While there is a novelization, it was never released in paperback form, nor will it ever be. And I'm not sure I would want to platform the person who... Fair dues, did a very good job writing the novelization, but there's no paperback cutdown. So I don't think, and Doctor Who Target Book Club podcast has already said we will never discuss this book because of the author.
Mm.
So I don't think it'll ever come up as a novelization. I want to discuss it at some point because I think Sharda is not as good as it should be. And part of that is filtered through the way that we see it. I mean, we see it as a incomplete VHS release with Tom Baker doing bonkers narration. We can hear it as a finished audio. You have the different animated versions going out there. And if you watch it in movie format, it doesn't quite work because some of the episodes are 29 minutes long before you get to the planned cliffhanger. And it would never have aired as a 29-minute episode in the spring of 1980. The one thing I have not seen yet is the 6-part episodic version of Sharda on the season 17 Blu-ray. That'll be the last one that I try to watch. That might help me like the story a little better, but I don't know. But I want to talk about Sharda at some point. I don't think it's great. I think it really wants to be City of Death, but it can't be because City of Death has already been done. And when I posted on my pilgrimage that I appreciated it but didn't love it, I got yelled at by a couple of people for whom Sharda is one of the all-time great stories. It's a debate that is worth having. I'm just not sure that I can fit that debate onto this program.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I'm just of the view, I guess, that the more Doctor Who, the better. So I'm predisposed to it on that score. But also, if it was made, I think it would be one of those stories that it probably wouldn't be an all-time classic. It wouldn't be a City of Death. It'd probably be, you know, a story that sort of sits in that rung or two below that. And we're probably harsh on it because we're coming to it with newer eyes in many ways. And it's not, right. You know, for instance, I don't know, the Armageddon factor, which I can forgive all of its sins because it's just so ingrained to my experience of, you know, reading and watching Doctor Who as a kid, really.
An Armageddon factor is fun to watch, and there's some really fun performances in it. Christopher Neame as Skagra is very, very one note and annoying, the exact opposite of Julian Glover, the other half of the season in City of Death. However, by the time he comes back to record lines for the animated reconstruction, he changes his performance. So his original performance, I'm not a fan of. I think he does a little better when he's recording 30 years after the fact. But he's not... The story revolves around him as an important villain, and I don't think he's one of the all-time great villains. So that's one of the reasons why the story, variously produced, doesn't quite work for me.
Mm. No, I can see that. Sure. Yeah.
So I am now going to reload the randomizer for my next victim. I mean, my next guest. Oh, interesting. Now, speaking of stories that I've written about and that you can debate, next 20 questions answer is a story that I'd be very happy to debate. And I'm not sure that it's going to be the first guess on anybody's tongues. We will see. So the randomizer has been reloaded, and my very next guest to do 20 questions will have to contend with the answer. But as we wrap things up here, Stephen, where else can we find you?
Okay, so I'm on Twitter, I guess, at Steve Stylin, without the G in all one word. Also, I've, not too recently, but perhaps in the last 6 months or so, launched a blog that nobody's reading. And that's okay, you don't have to read it. But it's a reimagining of classic Doctor Who right from the very beginning. If it were to sort of go to a Netflix or, for instance, a Disney Plus with that kind of budget, but also under the context, I guess, of the 21st century and the global viewership. And what would that look like if you were able to go back to Todd's Yard, which was speaking of that earlier, and reimagine Doctor Who in a tight format and with a great budget and a global reach? It was one of those lockdown projects that I did, and I can show you, just for Jason's benefit, because this is great podcasting, I have a leather-bound Moleskin that cover to cover is written in fountain pen. And this was the kind of, you know, sanity project, I guess, that I had during those, what was almost 2 years here in Singapore, where I wasn't able to effectively leave the island and see friends and family back home. So I sort of took that and shaped it, and it's now starting to go online month by month. I'm currently up to the Planet of Giants, and I've rejigged things and reimagined things, and people will probably shake their fist at me, but that's okay. This is a bit of a fool's errand that I'm on, and it's probably going to last me for many years yet, and I'm kind of just enjoying the process. So that you can find on reimagining.doctorwho.com. And I've also got a Twitter, which is Reimagining Who, as well. I hope I got the URL right, but even if that isn't right, I'm sure you can probably just Google it and find it. Reimagining.doctorwho.com is where the blog is at, or at least it should be.
And is that Dr. D-O-C-T-O-R, or is that Dr. D-R, the way that I have to do it for my podcast?
In full for the website. I'm just doing this on the fly just to double check this. And Reimagining Who is the Twitter handle, at Reimagining Who.
All right. I look forward to checking that out, and I will have a link to that in the show notes once we resolve the controversy of how you spell doctor. Stephen, thanks so much. Hopefully we get you back on here before the show runs its course.
Oh, I'd love that. Thank you, Jason. It's been really great fun, and so wonderful to share the love in Davison and that whole era, and I hope people look on Mordrin Undead a little bit more kindly perhaps after we've had a chat.
Although, given my reputation, I'm sure I've just condemned the story to a dark niche within the hearts of fans. All right, have a great night. Talk to you soon, buddy.
Thank you so much. Cheers, Jason. Bye-bye.
Doctor Who, Modern Undead by Peter Grimwade. Televised as Modern Undead, teleplay by Peter Grimwade. Televised in February 1983, paperback release date in January 12, 1984, target book number 82. The Doctor's time-traveling machine is trapped in the flight path of an alien spacecraft in orbit around the Earth. To avoid the fatal impact of a head-on collision, the TARDIS resorts to the only escape possible and materializes on board the oncoming liner. This solves the immediate problem, but a new difficulty arises. The TARDIS cannot get off the ship until a radio signal transmitting from Earth has been disconnected. The Doctor sets off in a transmat capsule, having programmed the TARDIS to enable Tegan and Nissa to follow him once he has dealt with the interference. Naturally enough, things don't go quite as planned. Pergola. Knurled. Cascara. Taramasalata. No, not alien monsters from the first Russell T. Davies era, though they sound like they were, or should have been. In point of fact, they're words. Obscure vocabulary words. Words that I didn't know before I first read the novelization of Modern Undead. And words I promptly forgot after almost every reading since they're not words often found in my daily life. Where I was faintly disappointed with Peter Grimwade's first Doctor Who novelization, Time Flight, episode 74 of this podcast, though not nearly as disappointed as Fraser Gregory was, I positively adore Modern Undead, which for me, and Stephen B. as well, as you just heard, is a case of Grimwade finally finding his voice, ironically, on a story put together on short notice. To be fair, it's not just the book I love. The TV story is in my upper tier of classic Who, although it does suffer a little bit by the abrupt shift from English public school comedy of manners in parts 1 and 2 to becoming a Star Trek TOS episode in parts 3 and 4. The Black Guardian subplot, while welcome and well done, does take real estate away from the A-plot. The book doesn't rectify this change in tone, but Grimwade's way with words and his dotting in character touches and continuity references keep things sailing. Sailing eternally, like Modron's ship. This is a clever book, and a nice change of pace after the previous two Terrence Dicks novelizations in story order, Arc of Infinity, episode 80 of this podcast, and Snake Dance, the forthcoming episode 84 of this podcast, both eminently readable, but not Terrence's masterworks. Modron changes things up by starting off as, like I said, a comedy of manners, using the above-noted vocabulary words. Doctor Who's best writers over the past 25 years all grew up on the Target books, and you know they went to school on Grimwade's vocabulary choices. And flashes of wit, to make this probably the most enjoyable book out of all the Peter Davison books released up to this point, January 1984, right behind Castro Valva, I think, which is slightly more clever. Make no mistake, though, the Modern Undead novelization is no mere exercise in fancy vocabulary words and self-congratulatory prose. Grimwade excels at comical insults and dry asides. The History of Brendan School features the aside, quote, "The battle had raged fast and furious as to whether Brendan Court should become an independent school for boys or an institution for the criminally insane. Education had trumped, though not noticeably so." Ibbotson, who I wish hadn't disappeared from the plot so early in Part 2, is contrasted with Turlough's, quote, "otherworldly pre-Raphaelite appearance." Ibbotson is described as, quote, "a lump," close quote. The school matron is a dictatorial old harridan. Turlough likens the 1983 version of the Brigadier to a cantankerous old pedagogue. Brendan School's chaplain, Canon Whitstable, is mentioned so many times that you almost forget he wasn't mentioned, let alone even seen, on TV. It takes a while for the Doctor and the TARDIS and Tegan and Nissa to show up, but that's no matter because Turlough, the POV character for the first chapter and a half, is a deliciously wicked, unreliable narrator. Grimwade hides the clues to Turlough's true nature in plain sight in the first few pages, using the word alien to describe him, and foreshadowing the importance of the obelisk on the hill overlooking Brendan School to Turlough's eventual escape from Earth. And yes, as Barsky told us last week in episode 81B, the use of obelisk in the Modern Undead novelization is a lot more accurate than the use in the Five Doctors novelization. Grimwade suffuses his adventure with wit and poetry. The Doctor believes that a ship traveling in a warp ellipse, like Modron's, quote, existed only in the imaginations of engineers and storytellers. The Brigadier has, quote, a long and acrimonious conversation with his insurance company, a scene I wish had been scripted for Nicholas Courtney to perform in. The headmaster at Brendan School, played on TV in all too few scenes by Angus MacKay, quote, was of the firm belief that excess of leisure could only lead to an unhealthy interest in music or the reading of books for pleasure, or worse. End quote. Speaking of Angus MacKay, here are excerpts from Angus MacKay's diaries from the summer of 1982, while he was part of the production of Modern Undead, curated, edited, and performed by Jim Sangster.
Friday, August the 13th, 1982. To the BBC in the morning for a fitting for Doctor Who. Delightful wardrobe girl, Amy Roberts, a reader. Must chat to her again. Married and lives near here. Monday, August the 23rd, 1982. To first reading of Doctor Who at Threshold House. As I thought, Peter Davison is a dear. Sunny and warm, and very mercenary, I dare say. A bright, sparky little girl called Janet Fielding and I struck up a good talk. All through the reading, whenever they were free, the three principals were signing coloured postcards of themselves. Dear old Nick Courtney was there. Hadn't seen him since, Birmingham. In the evening, to dinner with dear George Rowell at the Garrick Club. Oh, I do enjoy going there, as it is in itself part of the old theatre I loved. And it is crammed with relics and records of it. It was very sweet of George to suggest that he puts me up for the club. I bet Peter Barkworth will blackball me. Tuesday, August the 24th, 1982. Was telling Kay about the Garrick visit, and he suddenly hit out with how he hated all that sort of thing. I said about the pictures. Oh yes, he said, that makes it very interesting, in a horrible sarcastic voice. He went on even worse when I said I'd been put up for it. I told him of something I'd really enjoyed and been thrilled by, and he spat at it. He was really nasty. I felt sick. And he never noticed how deeply he'd hurt me. Sometimes I wish I'd never met him or let him stay here. Thursday, August the 26th, 1982. Yesterday was an awful day. I went filming for Doctor Who at Trent Park. I wonder what on earth Philip Sassoon would think of it now. I enjoyed walking in the still beautiful garden and park. Roger Hammond is nicer and more pathetic than I thought. Of course, I finished the day, as I finish every filming day, exhausted from standing in an irritated, tearful rage. Wednesday, September the 8th, 1982, to Thursday, September the 9th, 1982. Studio days.
Grimwade seasons his character's internal thoughts with continuity references as a reward to the reader going in story order. There are callbacks to Captain Stapley from Grimwade's own time flight, to Logopolis, which Grimwade directed, and from which he borrows the line wheezing like a grampus, and to the death of Adric, which Grimwade also directed. Other bits of verbiage are too obscure, perhaps, for this American reader. One character smiles like a Dutch uncle. I don't know what that is. But, fine, that was about the only sentence I didn't appreciate. The rest of the time, Grimwade writes picturesque and poetic prose, seemingly without effort. There was a splendid view over the tops of the trees into the valley below, the sun dappling the lake, the old house seeming to doze in the afternoon warmth, the distant pirouette of white flanneled boys on the cricket pitch. How typical of the earth, of England. So complacently pastoral. Hardly the time and place for acts of destiny. Of course, Grimwade also enjoys graphic revulsion. As they looked closer, Tegan and Anissa could recognize vestigial limbs and the outline of a mangled trunk that wept pus through charred clothing. Then, as the deformed body twisted itself towards them, they gazed upon a face that, though ravaged beyond all recognition, had once been that of a man. And later, Modron drags himself along a corridor, quote, like a slug. Yeah. One of my favorite bits of the book, as a kid, was the montage of the 1983 Brigadier's memories being recovered under the Doctor's light hypnosis. That helped me, as a young fan, fill in a lot of unit-era gaps, which I then had in my fandom. The TV production of the scene is also phenomenal, thanks in no small part to Paddy Kingsland's surging rock god score. Let's give a listen.
Are you all right?
Someone just walked over my grave.
Perhaps it was a Yeti. Colonel Lethbridge Stewart.
One lump too, Brigadier. Well, bless my soul. So you've done it again, Doctor.
And of course, Grimwade is able to do even better than Paddy Kingsland's score on pages 43 and 44 of the book, where he narrates several scenes from past Brigadier stories from the Brigadier's point of view. Danger! Darkness and terrible danger. Abominable snowmen in the underground. Saved from the Yeti by the most peculiar man with a flute. Who was this? Doctor. Promoted brigadier. Seconded unit. Enemy in the sewers. Silver things. Bionic monsters. Cybermen. Saved again by the Doctor. And a few paragraphs later. Don't worry, Doctor. We'll deal with that robot. Strike command coming over in 4 minutes flat. Alien planet? Don't believe a word of it. That's Cromer out there. Where are you, Doctor? Doctor? The Brigadier opened his eyes. Once the story shifts locales from Brendan's school to Modron's ship, the poetry and humor recede into the background. Grimwade places considerable emphasis on the luxury of Modron's surroundings and on the horror of his and his comrades' bodily degeneration. One thing we don't get, unfortunately, is too much insight into Modron's background. Where was he from? How did he manage to steal Gallifreyan equipment? Why was he hoping to achieve immortality? For as many scenes as Grimwade narrates from Modron's POV, there are some clear gaps in the record that one wishes had been filled in. But at least Modron's death scene is lovingly written, quote, his unfettered spirit soared beyond the realms of time and space. In lieu of that, Grimwade puts an interesting spin on Turlough. We discussed this in episode 79, the Terminus novelization, Turlough's second TV story, but adapted as a book first. By the time the Modron book comes out in January 1984, this is Turlough's third book, but the novelization of his first TV story. Turlough was left ambiguous in his first three TV serials. Did he really want to murder the Doctor? He remained shifty and cowardly in most of his follow-up TV stories. But Grimwade was one of the few freelance show writers who got to both introduce and write out the same companion. Imagine if Chris Boucher had been able to write Leela's swan song. Grimwade clearly had a story arc in mind for the boy from the beginning, so he plays down the evident villainy that, for example, Stephen Gallagher would dwell on at length in Terminus, the book. Instead, Grimwade tells us repeatedly that Turlough is taken with the Doctor instantly, realizes that the Doctor is good to the Black Guardian's evil, realizes that the Black Guardian is going to kill him, even if he succeeds in his mission, and lastly realizes that he wants to be on the Doctor's side. On the one hand, this takes some of the tension and ambiguity out of the book. On the other hand, it's good to know early on that Turlough's going to come out okay.
There's nothing to be afraid of, Turlough, now that you've explained everything to me.
Thank you, sir.
In fact, I'm very heartened that you felt able to confide in me like this. I must say, it's a most remarkable story.
But what am I to do, sir?
Seems to me you're in something of a moral dilemma.
Sir?
You've accepted a free passage home to your own people. But to fulfill your part of the bargain, you have to kill this Doctor.
But I don't want to kill the Doctor.
I can see you're in a most invidious position.
Haven't I done enough to separate him from his TARDIS?
I take your point, but in your heart of hearts, do you entirely feel you've completed your side of the bargain?
I suppose not.
We can't get everything we like in this world.
Oh, please help me, sir.
I'm afraid I can only put the problem in perspective for you. The final choice has got to be yours.
Well, I think I'm pulling out. The Doctor's stranded, but what's been done for me? I've been ignored. I shall try and escape in the transmat capsule. He can sort the Doctor out for himself from now on.
Is that your final decision?
Yes, sir.
Are you absolutely sure?
Yes.
Waking or sleeping, you can never escape me, Turlough.
Police! I love Doctor Who stories where the title villains are not necessarily evil. And I like reading novelizations that add humor, funny descriptions, biting satire, or that hint at the private off-screen lives of their characters. Modern Undead checks off almost all of those boxes. It's not a top 5 target for me, but it's easily top 25, if not better. There is something here to enjoy for all Doctor Who fans. Except for Dutch Uncles.
Waking or sleeping, you can never escape me, Turlough.
Police!
You see, wretched, duplicitous child, I know your every innermost thought.
Leave me alone, please!
I invade every particle of your being. You will never be free of me until our bond is honored.
The Doctor isn't as you say!
I am the Black Guardian. The Doctor's good is my evil.
No!
You will absorb my will. You are to be consumed with my purpose. The Doctor shall be utterly destroyed.
The Doctor shall be utterly destroyed.
Next time on Doctor Who Literature, when we return to the Target novelizations, it will be a 2-book cycle of the Christopher Bailey Mara stories. First, Kinda, book 84 in the Target line, and Snake Dance, book 83 in the Target line, confusingly published out of order, so that book 84 arrived on the shelves before book 83. We will be covering the books in publication order, not numerical order, and in story order, first Kinda, and then Snake Dance. eagle-eared listeners will have noted that I have already had two guests named Smith covering the Five Doctors, and in the next 2 weeks, I will have two different guests named Smith, one to discuss Kinda, and one to discuss Snake Dance. Next week, joining me for the second and hopefully not for the final time, definitely not for the final time, is Doctor Who novelist, Black Archives writer, fan of the show, and a very good friend of mine, Dale Smith. Next time on Doctor Who Literature. Thank you for joining me on another episode of the Doctor Who Literature podcast. This podcast is produced by David Barsky, Jim Sangster, and yours truly. This week's episode was written and edited by me. Our logo was designed by Jim Sangster. Special thanks to my special guest, Stephen B., from the New to Who podcast. This podcast can be found on most of your podcast apps of choice. You can find all past episodes at podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/Doctor Who Lit. It really helps if you rate 5 stars and subscribe. You can find me on Twitter at Doctor Who Novels, that's Dr. Who Novels, and on Mastodon at Doctor Who Novels, Dr. Who Novels at mastodon.social, and on email at Doctor Who Literature, that's Dr. Who Literature at gmail.com. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Thank you for listening, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages.
Doctor Who Podcast Network.